It is time for Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. I'm Heidi Holton. With me are Aaron Brown from Minnesota Brown. He is our liberal commentator, and Chuck Barone. He's from Strong Towns. He's our conservative commentator. We take up a topic and take a look at it through three installments on air as well as our podcast. Thanks for being here, you guys.
Good to be here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, one of the topics, because we always ask people what they might want us to talk about, it's come up a couple of times, is education, which is a huge thing to start talking about. But we begin our segments talking about the past and the history, and where should we begin here in terms of the past of education, how the schools were here?
I think we should go back to Thomas Jefferson and the idea of settling this Louisiana territory. Back when Congress at the time, which was actually before the Constitution, so you're talking about the Articles of Confederacy, set up the system of 6 mile by 6 mile grids across Minnesota and really the bulk of the Louisiana Purchase. And when they set this up, Thomas Jefferson, it was his like inspiration. He actually wanted 10 mile by 10 mile grids. And, you know, the surveyors pushed back because we didn't have a decimal-based system at the time. They wanted this grid, and they set aside two of the sections within each township. So a township is 6 miles by 6 miles. There's two sections that are set aside for public use. And the idea was that one of these would be a school. And so the vision of, if we want to call them the founding fathers, or we can just go to Jefferson that was supported by others at the time, was that across this nation, we would have every 6 miles a public school. And that public school would teach Greek to farm kids and teach Latin and give them good writing and arithmetic skills. The vision of people like Jefferson and like Madison that were there coming up with these things was that we would have this educated agrarian country. We would have farmers who during the day toiled in the fields and then in the evening came back and by candlelight studied Greek and Latin and read the classics, and we would become this kind of utopian country. That was the vision. And that vision was carried out with this idea of setting aside space in every township for a school.
And then we saw it kind of come through to the future, and just looking at the state of Minnesota and its history, which in terms of settlement began in the 1800s, and Minnesota was settled by New England Yankees at first. That was the heart of a liberal America that believed in progressive education, this accessible education, and they came in very much with the mind of creating an education-friendly state. They were then joined by, in large quantities, Scandinavian immigrants who settled this country, along with Germans and many others. But Scandinavians in particular came over from their country hungry for land, which we had, and they were literate and they wanted education. And so the population of the state of Minnesota quickly became very open to the Jeffersonian idea that Chuck just mentioned, the idea that no matter where you were in the state of Minnesota, there would be an accessible public school. And it was a public school. And that was one of the big early debates in Minnesota. You know, the Germans and Irish came, and there was a strong parochial school movement in those populations, the Catholic parts of those populations. But the Scandinavians and Protestant Germans and the Yankee folks from the Americans from out east believed in public schools. That was the ruling thought of the time, the politically successful thought of the whole 1800s, then leading into, you know, the settlement of northern Minnesota, where we are now. And those ideas became, you know, really part of how our communities were founded in this area.
And understand what the radical part of this is, because America at this time in particular was this idea of self-governance. We look back today and we see that it really wasn't complete self-governance. It was governed by, you know, the propertied class and male. But for the time, this was a radical departure from the way, the blue blood aristocratic way that governance had been done. And the trade-off of this was this idea and this notion that regular people are capable of learning and capable of self-government. But those two things go together. So if we're going to have self-governance, we have to have people that are educated and that can understand the issues and make decisions. And so it was important on us as a republic to ensure that that was done. And that was actually a public good, that was something that went hand in hand with the idea of a representative democracy.
How were the schools funded? You said there was a space for those schools that's put there, but how did they operate? How did all that
It's go? Really fascinating because if you look back at the old schools, and we had one in Baxter right up the street from the Marone Road, this place where all these crazies lived in Baxter, just actually a couple parcels up, there was this little tiny building that was a schoolhouse. And these were buildings that were often constructed the way you would do barn raisings. People pitched in, they would show up, they would put up the sides and haul the wood and pitch their money together to hire a teacher who would work during non-farm parts of the year teaching the kids. This was truly a community effort at the very local level. You know, we want our kids to be educated. We have a place to do it. Let's all pitch in and get this done.
The first Cherry school, I grew up in Cherry, and it was built much the same way. My very first school I went to was the Forbes Elementary School, and it's a little railroad junction southeast of Cherry. And the building's still there. It's been a restaurant, it's been a bar, it's been a union headquarters, it's been, now I think it's apartments. Anyway, the building's still there, but all of those townships in rural St. Louis County, it used to be a much larger network of schools, and they were often boxy buildings with eight rooms, and each room was a grade level and maybe a principal's office, and they were kind of followed a cookie cutter plan. A lot of them came in, a lot of the ones I'm describing came in the 20s. But there were predecessor buildings like the ones Chuck describes.
This is what you would do. I mean, if you wanted to establish a community, so you were going to go and you were going to be a farmer, or you were going to be a logger, or what have you, and you were going to have land. And remember, a lot of this was, for this part of the country, was tied to the Homestead Act. So we had people coming out and getting 80 acres, 160 acres, and farming that. Part of coming out to this wilderness area was that, you know, there was a meeting hall where the government, whatever that was going to be at the very small at the local level, would be able to meet. You would have your rudimentary police, you know, like a county sheriff or what have you. You would have elections, but you would also have that building as your one-room schoolhouse. And that was how these places got started. That was part of the deal. So if you're a Norwegian immigrant, a Prussian immigrant like my grandfather coming here homesteading the place, part of what you were being sold as the package was not only land that you could farm and improve and own, but you could also send your kids to a place where they could better themselves. That was the American package. That's what we sold.
It's Dig Deep. We're talking education. This is the first installment, so we're looking at the history. So when did things change? Why did they change? The word consolidation.
Yeah, well,
is big.
We went through a period of time, and I can't say that I'm completely versed on all the nuances of this, but certainly as communities grew, public education became a more formal undertaking. You can see even in the 1800s and 1700s in the East, where you have universities being established and secondary schools being established, and even elementary education became a far more formal thing. In this part of the world, that happened around the time of the Civil War, and we see communities, it's still all, you know, not statewide in a sense, but still all very local based, but it becoming a far more formal thing where you're actually taxing people and appropriating money that way. It was less voluntary and more prescriptive. We went through a period of time then after World War II, from a national level, this trauma with integration and segregation, Brown versus the Board of Education and other things that came out of that, that changed the nature of urban schools. But rural schools, particularly in this part of the world, weren't impacted as much of that until we get to the 80s. And we had made education now a local state partnership. And the state part of that really pushed us into consolidation. And that has had major impacts really ever since the early 1980s here.
And I think we've skipped over something, which is the role that schools came to take in the community as our communities grew. And here's where we get into some of our local communities. I talk about the city of Hibbing, where I was born. I didn't go to school there. I was out in Cherry, the suburbs. But that's a joke. But
I didn't get it. No, and now you said that, and I think it's
Cherry fun. it's a hay farming community. It's not the suburbs. But anyway, it's outside of Hibbing. So in Hibbing, you have this environment where you had a muddy logging village with wood planks getting you from building to building, and you can't cross the street in the wrong time of year. Livestock roamed. You know, it was that kind of place. And within 20 years, you got opera houses and paved streets and more streetlights per capita than probably anywhere in the state. So in that shock explosion of development, and it's all related to the growth of the mining industry, you also have the community need to move 5 miles to the south to accommodate mining. And the population at the time is overwhelmingly immigrant and blue-collar working-class people who don't make much money at the time. They, you know, a mining job was not necessarily the high-paying job it would be seen as today. So what motivated, what got their votes, what got the deals done? And the idea was that you didn't just have a school to educate your child in to read and write, but you would have a school that would become a tool of upward mobility for people whose sole motivation was a better life for their kids. So we go from reading and writing in a one-room schoolhouse or a small school to the idea that we're going to have elite music programs, and we're going to have elite vocational programs, and we're going to attach a junior college to the high school so that we can train people for other jobs right out of high school. I work at Hibbing Community College. That's our foundation, 1916, a junior college attached to the high school. The school became something much bigger than just teaching. It became where people would learn language. You know, it became the place that unified a place with 43 ethnic groups and really the hallmark of the community. And it's not just in Hibbing, but it's not just the range. You know, a lot of these small towns came to look at their schools that way. And when the money was available, which is during the period of development and the strength of when small farms were viable and all of these things were the case 100 to 75 years ago, you saw the schools become something truly special, almost like a diamond glowing in the sun. And then to come back to where Chuck left off, the 50s, 60s, and 70s were this kind of golden era of education where we were still living off of that mining revenue and things that were paying for the schools. But then come the 70s and come especially the 80s and 90s when I was in school, you saw the first inkling of budget cuts, you know, and every year as a student, I just remember this, I was involved in a lot of things, and every year meant some of your favorite teachers would lose their jobs and some of your favorite clubs would go away.
And it's interesting because we had that same experience, although very different places. In Brainerd, our schools were not a byproduct of the mining wealth. They were a byproduct of the 1930s Depression programs. The great schools in Brainerd were almost all built during the Depression. You can go into them today, and Lowell School, where I went, where my mom went, where my kids just finished up, right on the wall there's a little plaque about the year it was built and how it was funded through New Deal programs. You look at those buildings, and they were designed to be neighborhood anchors. So not only did they serve as a place to educate kids, but they had an architectural style, a relationship to the community, an open door policy where you would have voting there, you would have community meetings there. It was almost like a community cultural center in addition to being the school. And so we get up to this period of time where we have, I think, the stress of having the state having budget crises and having a lot of our local education now funded by the state. And so even in a school district like mine, which at the time was adding students and growing quite rapidly, we had the same exact budget problems that Aaron is describing in communities where you're actually losing students and losing population. So it's in a sense like a universal experience, except for some of the Twin Cities suburbs where there was no school and they were building fresh, brand new. Most of our districts around the state experienced this pressure to consolidate because the money just simply wasn't there to continue to do things the way we had been doing them. I want to talk a little bit about consolidation because I think there's some important inherent assumptions behind it that I think drive not only what happened, but where we're at today and the prism that we look through things with. And I remember this very vividly from being a kid. If you look at two elementary schools, back when I went to one, it had its own principal, and the other school had their principal. And you kind of had like a relationship with your principal. They knew who you were. They would roam the halls. They would give high fives. They were like the head teacher. So there was this relationship between them and the teachers of like a mentor coach kind of thing. And you felt that as a kid. I mean, it was part of the package. It was part of the deal. Then we went through this notion where, okay, maybe we can save money by just having one principal be the principal for two schools. Like, wouldn't that be great? These schools are within driving distance of each other. You can get there in 15 minutes. So let's just take this administrative person and put them in charge of two groups of teachers instead of one. And there's some base budget consideration that makes a lot of sense there, right? We cut a salary. But what happens and what you see happen time and time again, and you get this when you close schools and consolidate schools, and you get this, you know, as we try to become more efficient, what happens is now that principal has two schools. Well, they need a deputy assistant because, boy, they got double the teachers to deal with now. And they're going to need someone to do union negotiations for them. And they're going to need, you know, a secretary, and their assistant's going to need a secretary. And all of a sudden, what you see is that our level of administration grows and has grown exponentially since the early 1980s. And as a parent, the distance between me and the people who are actually making decisions in the school has grown exponentially too. So we've addressed this problem of not having enough resources as one of rote efficiency. And the byproduct of that has been to make our schools very hyper-efficient in terms of how they're administered and governed, but very confusing and oftentimes very disconnected from the student experience, the parent experience, and often the classroom experience.
I think one of the big things to consider, I've gotten into some debates about this because I've been more, for liberals and pro-education people, I would fall in the camp of being much more open to strategic consolidation than most of my compatriots would be. And I'm talking about the Iron Range in particular as a place where this could work. One of the challenges we have there is that you had these beautiful schools built all around the same era. All these communities are pretty much the same age and all formed much the same way, and the schools followed a pattern, and the schools were usually very well built, beautiful buildings at the time of their construction in the 1900s and 10s and 20s, which is getting to be, well, it is 100 years ago. So these are buildings that now need internet, that now need better wiring, and now need elevators and code and everything that your school's supposed to have for all the students that they educate. So we've got a string of communities, 12 plus communities, each with a building in the community built as a school. And we're graduating, in some cases, some of these schools are graduating 28 students for a school that was built for a graduating class of 100 or 200. That's difficult to maintain from a financial standpoint. But the reason that I talk about consolidation is not just efficiency. I tend to follow Chuck's thinking that efficiency comes with other non-efficient things. And it's usually, it's not just an assistant to help with the negotiations. It's often a curriculum head. There's usually there's someone to deal. But a lot of that has to do with the interplay between the local district and the state and the paperwork involved. The thing that gets me in watching what's happened to a lot of these smaller Iron Range schools is that when they shrink like that, they're still in the same building. The building still needs to be heated, and it's the heating and upgrade and maintenance costs of these older buildings. It's the transportation cost. People now live further out than they used to. It used to be 90% of your students lived in the city limits. Now they live out on properties outside of town, so busing is a bigger concern. But the thing that gets me is curriculum, is the idea that there are districts where you have to enter a lottery to see if you can take chemistry, which is one of the major classes you need if you're planning to go to college. Now, 20 years later, the same schools across the range don't offer some of the classes I was able to take. Foreign languages are harder to find. What I'm seeing now that I'm a college instructor, community college instructor, is a lot of these small schools, the kids go to community college through the post-secondary enrollment program. That's a whole other topic, probably. But the point is, the reason they're doing it is, yeah, they save some money, but also because they can't get the classes at their school. Often it's the smallest schools that end up doing the most of this, which ends up just having a really negative financial effect on those schools. So if it's not consolidation, somehow a way of generating a pool of students that can support the necessary curriculum, the stuff we want kids to know to be adults, to qualify as high school graduates, we're having a hard time delivering those services to students. And that's the part that for a lot of rural Minnesota, northern Minnesota in particular, that's what a lot of these districts are struggling with.
A decade ago, Governor Pawlenty was roundly laughed at and criticized for suggesting that distance learning was something that we should be seriously looking at. The idea that kids could, on a computer, learn more than maybe in a traditional classroom setting. It's actually a very valid insight. We are still locked in a conversation, even though we have this highly connected, highly technological world. We're still locked in a school funding paradigm that involves buildings. And we're driven by huge capital investments in terms of how we structure everything. And until that changes, we're not going to be able to modernize our schools and really change our approach to meet the needs of students and teachers today.
I think most people in education agree that the relationship between the teacher or teachers and student are the paramount thing that needs to work. And whether we're talking about bricks and mortar or curriculum or some of these other parts of the education debate, that's the part that needs to get figured out.
We will take up capital improvements bonding in our next segment of Dig Deep on Education. It's Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone.